Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Well, we finally have a new show. It's been kind of weird because of the stay-at-home orders, the lockdown, quarantine, whatever you want to call it. And also, I have this sexy allergy voice going on. I promise you I do not have COVID-19, but I do have seasonal allergies, and it's weird going out, even in a limited way. And you sneeze or you cough and people look at you like you're some kind of maniacal serial killer or something. Anyway, my guest today is Adrisa Pandit. She's a social justice activist and an interdisciplinary studies scholar based in Waterloo, Ontario. Adrisa is also the founder of Muslim Social Services of Kitchener-Waterloo and a member of Interfaith Grand River. Adrisa has been recognized for her volunteerism and community contributions. Among her numerous awards are the University of Waterloo 2017 President's Community Award, Ontario's 2016 Leading Women, Leading Girls Award, and the Oktoberfest 2016 Woman of the Year Award. Adrisa's research and writing focuses on interfaith relations, anti-oppression, anti-racism, gender and Islam, and the Kashmir conflict. Stay tuned and we'll be right back with Adrisa Pandit.
Adrisa Pandit, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much for having me, Cindy.
Before we get started with the actual questions of the interview, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am an academic by profession. I live in Canada, Waterloo, Ontario currently. I've lived in the States a number of years. I went to school there, worked there, moved to Canada about 15 years ago. And I am a native of Kashmir, which is what we will be talking about. And I was born and raised there, lived there until my late teens, and since then, I've lived all over the world doing many different things. I organize a group of Kashmir scholars that work on the issue of Kashmir, and I'm quite involved in anything that is related to my native land. So that is my association with what we'll be speaking about today.
Okay, so great. Tell us about the political and social situation there right now, maybe with a little bit of historical background or context.
Yes. So to capture it in just the shortest amount of time possible, the Kashmir conflict, has a very long and oppressive history, unfortunately, but the current manifestation of it goes all the way back to 72 years, which is in 1947, when they divided the Indian subcontinent into India and Pakistan, and there were 500 other territories that had to make a decision about what they wanted to do and where they wanted to go. And Kashmir has been an independent territory all along. And at that time, the ruler of Kashmir, who, by the way, was in that position because of some of the treachery of the British. In other words, our land and people were sold to him, to his ancestors, in a very cunning way. And he was of Hindu faith, while the majority population of Kashmir is Muslim. So the way when they divided, they partitioned the subcontinent, it was that those who are of those outstanding territories, which were 500 little kingdoms, they had a choice to go either with India or with Pakistan, and or to remain independent. And in this case, the ruler at that time was leaning more towards independence, yet under a lot of pressure from the Indian government and the machinations of the leaders at that time, including the first Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, and their intervention, they forced him to consider India more favorably. There is a very disputed article which is called the Instrument of Accession, which is the temporary arrangement that was signed by this ruler, who was an unpopular, undemocratic ruler over a people at a time when there was already a rebellion going on against him and his rule, who signed this unpopular, without consent of the people, this temporary arrangement with the Indian government, under the pretext that his territory was under threat. And this instrument of accession was supposed to be a document that was a temporary in nature, as I said, but it was also the only legal link for the Indian government to send its troops, supposedly to defend the territory. In this whole process, the ruler just escapes and leaves the area and flees to another part of India. But Indian troops land immediately after in this territory. And since then, we have had three full-fledged wars between India and Pakistan, both of whom claim the territory. Currently, there's about 65% under the Indian control and 35% under the Pakistani control, although there is a certain chunk also, which is disputed, and under Chinese control. Most of that land is not habitable land. So you have the parties, fighting over the land and people of Kashmir. Mostly the Indian side is the Indian occupied or administered side is the large chunk of the land, and which is where I come from. The capital is Srinagar. We have two capitals, summer and winter. And the valley of Kashmir is the one that has been at the center of the current popular instruction, which has been going on since 1990. And in the process, there has been enormous loss of life. About 100,000 people and more have died. Tens of thousands of young men have disappeared in thin air. Hundreds of thousands of women that don't know the fate of their husbands who have disappeared. We call them half widows. And similarly, children have no idea of their parents, families who have no idea of their sons. We have had, unbelievable excessive, excesses against the population in the forms of severe human rights violations and abuses, including torture and sexual violence and all sorts that you can possibly think of at the hands of the Indian army that is deployed in this territory. There is a soldier for every 9 people.
Wow.
It's the highest militarized zone. In these COVID times, to give you a sense of a comparison, there are less than 200 ventilators for a population of 8 million people. But there is a soldier for every 9 people. So, and there's only one doctor per a few thousand, and yet, we have such you know, armed presence in the region. So yeah, so that's really you know, in a nutshell, to tell you that the Indian Armed Forces operate within that region with absolute impunity because of the laws that are in place, such as the Armed Forces Safety Act. So in other words, they can commit murder and they can, you know, rape and go on do anything, but no one will hold them responsible for that. And also with the all sorts of extrajudicial killings and other sort of forms of human rights violations. And currently, you know, that is, you know, what is happening since August the 8th, which is when the Indian government, in contravention with the international law, as well as against their own constitution, really, you know, really tried to occupy the territory, really take control over the territory and change the status of the territory. That happened on August the 8th in 2019. And again, for your listeners to understand what that means is that Kashmir has been under a lockdown since then. So this current lockdown, because of the pandemic, is really because, you know, it, the pandemic is something that is new, but to understand that, you know, millions of these people have been under a lockdown, and that lockdown, you know, involved absolute disconnection with the rest of the world, you know, and there was no access to any form of communication. So there was a complete communications clampdown. So just as some of those restrictions were being eased, you know, comes on the heels of that comes the lockdown for the pandemic, which unfortunately currently the Indian government is also using to further, you know, their oppression within the territory by using the excuse of the lockdown to further create, you know, super surveillance and you know, find mechanisms of controlling the population there. At the same time, they have used the excuse of the lockdown to change some of the fundamental aspects of the nature of the territory and the political situation there. What they've done is that they have instituted a new domicile law. So because Kashmir is an internationally disputed territory, only the residents who were the state subjects of the independent territory of Kashmir had access to land, jobs, and everything else. In other words, there was a defined residency. So after August 2019, when they abrogated one of the articles in the constitution, which was the only link between the Indian Union and Jammu and Kashmir, the territory, they have started to go ahead and institute laws that have basically declared and instituted a demographic change. It's very much in line with the demographic changes, the Israeli-style demographic change in that territory, by you know, allowing non-citizens of that territory, given that it is an international disputed territory, to come and have access to the land and jobs and resources. At the same time, they have also instituted severe you know, measures of economic extraction, because for 9 months now the population has been under lockdown. There has been no business, there has been no education, there has been nothing. Wow. And amidst this, now they have the pandemic to deal mm-hmm. with. So it's a complete breakdown of the infrastructure, zero resources, no investment, destruction of forests and other natural resources, and a complete, you know, oppressive atmosphere, even at this time of a health crisis, where people in Kashmir still are not allowed access to 4G internet. So the lowest speed of internet was just eased about a month ago. And that doesn't allow the healthcare workers who are at the front line trying to fight this pandemic to even respond, you know, by having access to basic information, both from the WHO or even from the local medical associations. You know, they also are hampered in their connection with other doctors and medical professionals and frontline workers. So it has created an absolute crisis. Also, what happened in August is that they, Indian government, detained tens of thousands of people preemptively. And so at one point, there were estimates of about 10 to 13,000 young boys as young as nine, you know, in detention. And these preemptive detentions have been very classic under this law that the Amnesty International calls the Lawless Law. It's called the Public Safety Act. So under this law, they can just pick up a person, put them in prison, and that person can stay in prison for up to 2 years without any charge. And so many of these prisoners who are ordinary people as well as lawyers, academics, in fact, the head of the Kashmir Bar Association, human rights activists, even the politicians who were in favor of their Indian nationalist policies, even those were put behind bars. And many of them remain under custody, even during this time of the pandemic, when we know that the conditions in the prisons are really, really bad. And most of these prisoners have some severe ailments, particularly the head of the Bar Association and several other political leaders who have been held in detention. So the situation in, you know, overall for people within the valley especially is suffocating and absolutely oppressive. But even those of the people who have been held in detention and continue to be held in detention is unacceptable and a violation of their fundamental human rights because they have no recourse to justice. And regardless of how much you know, others have tried and have spoken, the Indian government seems absolutely unmoved and is continuing with its policies. And I think one of the important things to remember is that this is all happening, all the changes that have occurred in Jammu and Kashmir and all of the policies that are being implemented are being implemented by the current Indian BJP government, which is a as you and your listeners probably already know, is fundamentally an ethno-nationalist Hindu supremacist political party that wants to establish a majoritarian rule in that part of the world. And the best demonstration of that has been what has been happening in India recently in the last few months with the introduction of new citizenship laws which bars Muslims, which is 210 million people in India, from their rights of citizenship and questions them as Indian citizens. So it's a very bigoted and racist approach to their own citizens, let alone what is happening in Kashmir.
Wow, thank you so much. That was very informational. You packed a lot into into
I did,
yeah, sorry. You packed so much. That was like so you know, such a wide-ranging answer. But let's just bring it down a little bit. You still have family in Kashmir, right?
Yes, I do. Yes, I have my mother, I have my siblings, everybody still lives there. And it has been really, really difficult for the last 8.5, 9 months to be in touch. For many months, I could not even make a phone call. That even phone connections were cut off. And then once the landlines were eased, you still cannot, even today I cannot, because I never seem to get through on a landline. It always says that the number doesn't exist. And very slowly, once they allowed mobile phones, you know, to function again, only after they would have to register them with the government and so on and so forth, was I then able to communicate. And still the internet is disrupted, so there is no free communication. I mean, there has been absolute violations of fundamental freedoms of food and shelter and education and information particularly. And most of those things still continue. And so therefore, it's really been difficult for me to not just me, but most of the people who are in diaspora, to continue to remain in touch with families. And for me in particular, with an elderly mother and taking care of her 10,000 miles away, you know, over the phone and making arrangements for her care and, you know, and so on, has been really very, very challenging.
Right. How you're in Canada, and you know, I do live in the United States, unfortunately. But what are our government's response to this? Like, Genocide Watch has issued a genocide alert here since August of 2019. What has our government's response to this been?
Unfortunately, very, very lukewarm. There were two U.S. congressional hearings that were held on the issue, but there really hasn't been a response from the United States government. In fact, as you know, Modi and President Trump are close friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, amidst all of this, you know, there was this massive rally that was held in Houston, the Howdy Modi rally, and Howdy Trump and Modi and all of this. And then when Trump visited India, you know, the same thing. So creating these are two people who have very similar ideas and ideologies that they follow. I mean, Modi is a member of the Rashtra Swayam Sevak Sangh, which is the parent body, you know, of the current political party and its ideology, which has very deep connections with fascism. I mean, the founders of RSS are the people who look up to Hitler and Mussolini.
Right.
And these people that are very anti, you know, the founding father of their own nation, Gandhi. In fact, Gandhi is the most hated figure in their eyes. So this is the kind of a group that we're talking about. And the rise of this right-wing Hindutva ideology, which is different from Hinduism, just so that, you know, people understand that distinction, this political ideology, has taken over the whole country, unfortunately, and is very predominant. So there's a lot of, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment in particular, and both in the United States and in India. So there's a bit of a convergence there, you know, between the ideas of the ruling parties in both nations. So it's the response has been extremely poor. There has been absolutely no criticism of what India has been doing in Kashmir. Just like, you know, there hasn't been any criticism on the part of the Canadian government. So I think in both cases, their business and other relations seem to trump the fundamental, you know, obligations that all nations have under the right to protect, as well as even speaking against human rights violations. So that has been really dismal, and unfortunately, both in the United States and here in Canada.
It's really the figures that you put out are just heartbreaking and appalling. And while you were speaking, before you addressed it, I was thinking it sounds very similar to what Israel is doing in Palestine, you know, what the you know, Jewish state is doing in Palestine. I don't know. I'll take this out if you want. But from what Bob Fantina told me, your husband is Palestinian. That must be just make a very interesting combo there.
Absolutely. But you know what, it's really, really difficult to see how the Indian government, with very close ties with the Israelis, because they're the biggest purchasers of the Israeli weapons and arms. In fact, they have been training the Indians with regard to what to do in Kashmir. And so what happened in August 2019 was very much Israeli-style barricading of neighborhoods, the first time that it has been done this way, and cutting off people from one neighborhood to another. And they are now using the COVID-19 syndrome to create and institute permanent barriers. I mean, imagine you are creating cement barriers, cutting off one neighborhood from the other. The other day there was a fire, and the fire trucks could not get through because they have barricaded the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So what's the purpose of doing that? Is because they are using the current atmosphere of the pandemic to put in place policies that are going to be long-term. Because 19, the reason that they have preemptively arrested people, they have put a gag on anyone seeing out, they're even going after anybody who posts something on Facebook. I mean, arresting people over a social media post has been very, very common there. And nobody can speak out. And those who have been let out of prison, those politicians who are, by the way, their own supporters of the Indian government, even they have had to sign a bond that they will not speak against anything that the Indian government does. There has been no protest because they have killed every protest, you know, mm-hmm. with these policies of imprisoning people. There was one protest held way back in the fall by a group of women, and they were all arrested. Mm-hmm. So there is zero freedom of expression on the streets of Kashmir. And there's, you know, absolute fear and threat of all sorts of torture and imprisonment used to suppress any form of dissent. So this is really, really difficult. And all of these policies of imprisonment, preemptive imprisonment, and extrajudicial killings and torture and all of that, yes, are very much Israeli style. They are no different than what happens in Palestine.
Yeah, deplorable. You know, just absolutely abominable. So besides raising awareness, what are some of your strategies? Because obviously it's not possible or nearly impossible for the people of Kashmir to rally together and fight back. So what can we do as a global community?
I think it is extremely important for people to be, first of all, informed about what the whole issue is. I think most people are so uninformed because India has made it popular that somehow Kashmir is the integral part of their territory and that it is not. So it's very interesting. Every time, even when offered mediation, you know, all of a sudden, we don't want any external mediation, because Trump did offer a couple of times, uh-huh. You know, and he was turned down. The fact is that the Indian government refuses to even accept that there is a dispute. Or if they do accept, all of a sudden it becomes, it's a dispute between two countries, India and Pakistan, as if the people of Kashmir and the territory doesn't really matter, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's always it becomes a territorial dispute between two countries, and it is to this bilateral issue, which it is not. And so I think even just understanding what this whole issue is, that this is an issue that people of Kashmir have been fighting against oppression way before 1947. You know, the movement, the free movement, of ending oppressive regimes in Kashmir started way before. You know, and that has been ongoing. And this recognition that the current state of affairs is not something new that started in 1947, I think that's fundamental for us to understand that. Mm-hmm. But also from what happened, you know, in 1947, when this temporary arrangement was made, it was the Indian government that took the issue to the United Nations. So the issue is really the issue of self-determination. All the Kashmiris are asking is, give us the right to decide, which was promised to them in 1948 upon India taking the issue to the United Nations. That's the core of the issue. So all Kashmiris are asking is, let that plebiscite take place and let people decide their future, their political future, whether they want to stay with India, they want to go to Pakistan, or they want to stay independent. Again, people have varying opinions on that, but it is the people who need that democratic right to defend and define themselves and express that right of self-determination. And that is the whole core of the issue. And that is, you know, in today's world, why should we be, you know, refusing that right? Most countries, you know, wherever there has been dispute, you know, can be amicably and peacefully resolved. There needs to be a just and swift resolution to this, as per the wishes of the people. But what the current Indian Hindutva government is doing is, you know, bringing about things that are aimed at changing the demography of the place so that they can disrupt that process that has been promised and still upheld by the United Nations with numerous resolutions that are outstanding. So that is the first thing, that this issue is a human rights and humanitarian issue, that every person needs to understand that, and that the fundamental issue here is this right of self-determination that the Kashmiri people are asking for. And aside from that, the situation of oppression in the world's highest militarized zone, and with all of the human rights violations, it is the responsibility of each and every peace-loving person to seek some form of a just resolution to this issue. And so as citizens of the world, if we care about having a peaceful world or living in a peaceful world, we really need to pay attention to this part of the world, because both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers. And it has been projected, it was a study that was published in the journal Nature, that if there was to be a nuclear disaster or there was a nuclear war, you know, in that region, it is going to have devastating consequences for the rest of the world. And you can check out the study for yourself. But so, in other words, it's not just going to impact the people that live, you know, in the subcontinent, but it is going to have impact for every single individual on the face of this earth. So this is a nuclear flashpoint, and people need to start paying attention.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's been a concern for quite a while. But we should not just be concerned about, oh, how is this going to affect us? How is it going to affect the world? How is it affecting people right now who can't get to doctors, who can't, you know, go to work, who can't go to school, who can't shop, you know? And so anybody that is occupied or oppressed around the world, we suffer that, and we should be suffering. Like you said, any peace-loving person should be in solidarity with those people and doing everything we can. So in that vein, how can my listeners get more information and, you know, become more involved in this?
Sure. So one of the ways you can learn more about the issue and really in-depth understand various aspects of this issue is by going to the website called KashmirScholarsNetwork.org. There is a lot of information out there, and you can also follow them and see what action items are on their plate and what are the things that they are putting out. The other organization that is very much functioning out of the United States is this grassroots movement called Stand With Kashmir. So I would highly encourage your listeners to follow Stand With Kashmir and you know, learn a little bit more about the work that they do. Follow them on social media. They put out alerts every single day. So there are various avenues to learn more. So these are the two that are, you know, at the top of my head that I can think of that would be most useful, because you don't really get to read too much about Kashmir in the news. Although I would say since August 2019, New York Times and Washington Post and some of the other leading newspapers have carried stories on Kashmir, unlike many other media outlets. And that itself is very interesting because India bars foreign journalists' access. India bars human rights activists. It even bars the United Nations, group that is supposed to monitor the line of control, which is the de facto border between Kashmir and India and Pakistan. So, you know, there is no access to people who can go and assess the situation for themselves on the ground. So the few international journalists, you know, who were able to write about Kashmir, you know, had to go through hoops to write about it. Mm. And even though their first-hand accounts were disputed by the Indian media. So then in India, unfortunately, the media is completely co-opted aside from a few alternative sources where you can get some news on Kashmir. But otherwise, it's really, really difficult to find information because foreign journalists are barred from there. One of the things that I must mention is that in the 8 months of blackout and complete lockdown of Kashmir, it's some of the Indian civil society human rights groups that were able to go to Kashmir and bring us some news from the ground. And there were 7 to 8 reports that were published in the period up until January of 2020. All of those links are also available on the Kashmir Scholars Network website, so you can, your listeners can check that out as well. So, you know, it's a struggle to get news about Kashmir in the Indian media because, as with other cases, particularly with issues that have recently erupted in India over the National Register of Citizens and the Citizens Amendment Bill, the media is absolutely co-opted and is speaking the same language as the government, and it's really been difficult to distinguish the hoopla of the media and their ethno-nationalism and bigotry from that of the governmental policies.
Wow, sounds familiar. Sounds familiar over here. Well, Adisa Pandit, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we will get, I'll post all those links with the link to the show, and anything that you ever want us to, expose, send it, and we'll get, you know, as much exposure as possible for that. You know, anything that you want us to do, be in solidarity with, any actions or whatever, just let us know.
Thank you very, very much, and I most appreciate this time, and I will send you a few other links that you can post as well. Thank you again.
Yes, please do. Thank you, and I hope all the best for you and your family.
Thank you. Thank you. Most appreciate it. Thank you.
That's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to further research, and please check out all the information, all the links that Idrissa mentions in this interview. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Idrissa Pandit for her work and for agreeing to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to the Soapbox. Peace out for now.